John, for inviting me to celebrate your 100th anniversary with you. I'm going to talk about development of statistical concepts at Rothamsted. So I'm going to give a rather British perspective on the history of statistics, and I'll rely on the next two speakers to put me straight where I forget to mention anything from this side of the Atlantic. So it's going to be very much based upon the things that happened at Rothamsted, which I think pretty much set statistics in agriculture going, you know, back at the start of the last century. So if we look back 100 years, what did we know? Well, the first significance test took place in 1710, and I'll come on to that later on. So we knew about significance tests. We also had Bayes' theorem, which I think was as controversial then as it is in some quarters now. Least squares we knew about, so Gauss had used least squares to estimate the orbits of the planets, and there was a certain amount of controversy between him and Legendre as to who thought of it first. I think it's accepted these days that Gauss thought of it first, but Legendre published first, a nice distinction which I'm sure you're all still aware of in your own work. And then we had mathematical results like the central limit theorem, which says that large samples tend to behave like normal distributions. So this is in the mathematical statistics area, and certainly people who've done math stats diplomas or MSCs have been tested on this regularly in their end of year exams, and I could reproduce it too once upon a time. And then we had the biometric school of Carl Pearson and others at University College, which were looking particularly at correlation, chi-square, and estimating by the method of moments, by which I mean that you'd estimate by looking at the how the things like the the sums of squares or the sums of cubes and so on are related to various standard distributions. So not a lot of practical statistics. In fact, 100 years ago, I don't think there was anything on small samples, but shortly after, the t-test first came through by Gossett. And this is really what Fischel had to say about statistics in those days, a very nice quote from his Statistical Methods for Research Workers. "The traditional machinery of statistical processes is wholly unsuited to the needs of practical research. Not only does it take a cannon to shoot a sparrow, but it misses the sparrow." So this is where we were 100 years ago, and what you'll see is that Fischer and his colleagues pretty much set up the superstructure that you rely on now in your statistical research. So how did this all come about? Well, it came about because at Rothamsted, agricultural research had started in 1843. This is the Broadbalk experiment, which is the world's longest running field experiment, set up to study the effects of inorganic fertilizers on crop yields. I won't go through the treatments I did 2 years ago, but there are some traces of factorial structure, which is one of Fischer's criteria for experimental design. But there's no replication, no randomization, and no blocking, which is his other three. And no statistical analysis until 1919. So again, it's a paradigm which we see repeated all too often these days, that the data gets collected and it takes a while before the statistician gets called in. So this is the statistician, Ronald Elmer Fischer, and the reason why he was brought in was that by 1919, the then Rothamsted director was faced with, I quote, "great files of records," and he'd heard that in sampling, in official statistics, mathematicians existed who could make conclusions from this, and so he looked to see if the same thing could be done in agriculture. So he wanted a young mathematician prepared to examine the data and see what additional information could be obtained. So in his search, he got a reference from Fisher's tutor at Caius College, Cambridge, and essentially this reference said that Fisher could have been a first-class mathematician had he stuck to the ropes, but he wouldn't stick to the ropes. Well, Russell's reaction to that was that that looked exactly like the type of man that he wanted, so a mathematician who wouldn't stick to the ropes, And so he suggested that Fisher should come to Rothamsted and stay as long as the £200 that Russell had to fund this should suffice. Well, the story goes that it took a very short time for Russell to realise that Fisher was not just a person with great ability, but he was, I quote, a genius who must be retained. So Russell set about obtaining the necessary grant. Perhaps that has also some echoes in the current situation where you want to get staff in and you've got to try and then find a grant. The difference then, of course, was that Russell managed to get the grant. And so Fisher was at Rothamsted from 1919 to 1935 when he moved on to the University of London. And in fact, even after 1935, he kept in close contact with Rothamsted through his successor, Frank Yates, with whom he got on very well. So back to practical statistics. 99 years ago, the t-test was devised first by William Gossett, who worked at Guinness in Dublin, and as part of the interests of Guinness, they were growing barley and wanting to see how to grow that effectively in order to make the beer. And Gossett published under the pseudonym Student. Guinness didn't have the concept of people publishing their work, so he had to use a pseudonym. And the t-test first came out in Biometrica in 1908. So you're beginning to get some of the things that you need. Just in passing, I guess if you'd done a service course in statistics 100 years ago, it would have been a lot less trying than it would be now, because there was really much less to know. Gossett certainly knew of Fisher being appointed at Rothamsted, and I don't know whether he was consulted, but he was certainly in touch with Fisher before then, and he made the comment that there should be lots of interesting work to be done there, and they might easily have got someone there who would have been worse than useless. I'm not sure if this means a mathematician who would have stuck to the ropes, or someone who didn't know any mathematics at all, but he approved of Fisher being appointed, and as the future shows, he was quite right. He had a long correspondence with Fisher that is published, and Fisher used to bounce ideas off him. Gossett was a chemist rather than a mathematician, so I think he found some of Fisher's correspondence rather trying. And there's this nice comment that he made, that when he comes to the word evidently in Fisher's letters, he knows that at least 2 hours hard work is going to be required to figure out what Fisher means. And even 100 years on, or nearly 100 years on, I would say reading Fisher's papers, I had the same feeling. Now, even with the concepts well established, you look at some of Fisher's work and you can't quite see how he got from one piece of the argument to the next. So, as far as the t-test was concerned, Gossett originally derived it empirically. That is to say, he looked at the moments, in other words, the squares, cubes and products, and noticed that for the denominator, the standard error, this looked like one of Carl Pearson's standard distributions, and so he assumed, therefore, it was reasonable to assume that it was that distribution without proof. And the test was devised for small samples, and the test, of course, as you know, is that the sample mean is the same as some postulated population mean mu. And the point that Gossett made was that if we use a sample estimate for the standard error instead of some known value sigma, we can't assume that the difference between our sample mean and the one that we're testing will follow a normal distribution. Now, the methods of the day were very, very much based on normal distributions. You'd assume that you had a large enough sample that you could simply test this against normal tables. Gossett looked at various sample sizes and showed that this could be very misleading, and therefore he derived the t-test, which is part of our armory these days. Well, correspondence with Gossett before Fisher came to Rothamsted caused Fisher to recognise the concept of degrees of freedom, because originally Fisher thought that he should estimate the standard error with the divisor n instead of n minus 1, n being the number of observations, and he then realised that actually that wasn't right, it should be n minus 1, because essentially there were only n minus 1 degrees of freedom. Fisher recognised this by looking at, well, n-dimensional geometry. I should say he had very poor eyesight, and he did a lot of his mathematics in his head, and he also had a very strong geometrical insight, which was part of the reason why his papers were difficult to follow, because what was obvious to Fisher from his understanding of n-dimensional geometry wasn't necessarily obvious to the people reading it. But it was certainly what underwrote his strong intuitive feel of the mathematics that he was producing. So this caused him to recognize degrees of freedom. I think we understand degrees of freedom these days, do we? Do you all understand degrees of freedom? Well, nobody's admitting to it. It was certainly something that caused a lot of difficulty originally with Fisher, and I won't talk about the controversies that he had, but certainly there was a lot of disagreement with Carl Pearson over the degrees of freedom for the two by two table for chi-square. Pearson thought the degrees of freedom were three. Fisher was quite clear that the degrees of freedom were one. And nowadays, I think when we think of it more in terms of fitting models and testing the interaction between the two factors classifying the table, it's quite clear that it should be one. But in those days, it certainly wasn't, and a lot of acrimony was generated. So this was one of the concepts that Fisher found difficult to get across to the wider audience. But n-dimensional geometry was what helped him to do that. And so in 1922, he extended the use of the t-test to show that it would work for differences between means for analysis of variance, coefficients, regression coefficients, in both simple linear regression and multiple linear regression, or indeed for any statistic of the form of something from a normal distribution divided by something from the square root of the chi-square distribution. He also produced an expansion of the cumulative distribution formula in terms of inverse powers of n, and used that to form tables. So what you see here is that in 1922 and 1925, essentially, Fisher set up the full theory that you use in the general linear model, none of which, of course, existed beforehand. Another important contribution that Fisher made, which you use regularly now, is analysis of variance. And I think this is the first out of a table here. In a paper with his computing assistant, Miss McKenzie. Now notice that this was published in the Journal of Agricultural Sciences. A lot of Fisher's work appeared not in statistical journals, but in the applied journals. And this was very much part of Fisher's philosophy, that he was developing methods for practical use. And they would appear in the biological journals, and sometimes he would publish in the statistical journals, but it was more important to get the methods out and having them used. So this is the first ANOVA. And what we have here are 12 varieties, and then we have three manurial treatments, which are two dungs crossed with three fertilizers. And in the first analysis that he produced, he ignored the block structure on the design, which was a slightly unfortunate block structure, because the variety, the dung factor was actually aliased with half field. You had half a field with dung and half without. So we would recognize now that that would cause problems. Fisher, at that point, hadn't got in properly to design, so he ignored the block structure, which had plots crossed with rows nested within the half fields. But what he did was to fit the main effects of variety and manures and the interaction. And this was, again, before we had the concept of the F-ratio. He assessed it by assuming approximate normality of the log of the variances, which actually has echoes of what we would do now if we were analyzing variances, because we treat them as a generalized linear model, probably with gamma errors and with a log link. So it's foreshadowing things that we statisticians do now. The other thing that was in this paper, which was quite startling, considering that he was using hand calculators or electric calculators, was that he also fitted a multiplicative model for variety and manure by making eigenvalue decompositions. And this foreshadows, again, the sort of things that are done in econometrics or the additive main effects and multiplicative interactions models that I'm sure some of you use now. So again, one of the recurring themes throughout this talk is that Fisher was there first. When it comes to analysis of variance, Fisher very much regarded it not as a mathematical theorem, but simply as a way of doing the arithmetic. And if we look at the ways of doing the arithmetic, and this is going to be one of several slides where I look forward to what happened subsequent to Fisher, and you know, what we're doing now. As far as the arithmetic is concerned, I would also highlight Yates' algorithm for analysis of variance, which worked on differences for orthogonal designs with a single error term. The next thread would be Graham Wilkinson, who was at Rothamsted. Well, this was before he came to Rothamsted, but he was at Rothamsted from 71 to 76, and he extended this to balanced designs with several error terms, and then there's my own work extending that algorithm in various ways, which I'll refer to just to give myself a plug along with the other members of the department. Right, we've talked about the t-test. Another t-test, this relates to the tradition at Rothamsted back in the early days that people would gather for tea in the afternoon. And this was a very useful tradition because the scientists and the statisticians could talk together and postulate problems of interest and solve them. It was one of the ways in which Fisher, I think, was able to get his ideas used across a wide range of the scientific disciplines at Rothamsted. And we're told one day that a lady called Dr. B. Muriel Bristol was given a cup of tea by Fisher where he'd put the milk in second. And Dr. Bristol said, well, no, actually, she preferred to have the milk poured in first, please. And Fisher asked, how on earth can you tell? Is there a difference? And so the story goes that a test was organised immediately by her husband-to-be, William Roach, and Dr. Bristol could indeed tell whether the milk had been poured first. I haven't got the results of the experiment, but apparently she could. Now, Fisher used this in his book, The Design of Experiments. I'll read the paragraph as follows. A lady declares that by tasting a cup of tea made with milk, she can discriminate whether the milk or the tea infusion was added first to the cup. We will consider the problem of designing an experiment by means of which this assertion can be tested. And so he goes through all of the process of doing this and very nicely illustrates the concepts of randomization and significance and also develops the concept of an exact test where you compare what the lady, Dr. Bristol in this case, had found out with all of the permutations that might have arisen given that she's been given 8 cups of tea to taste, knowing that 4 have the milk put in first and 4 put in second. So this was the start of the exact test and was a very useful illustration of randomization and so forth, practical illustration. When it comes to significance tests, I did promise to go back to Arbuthnot, the Queen's physician in 1710, who noted that in 17 successive years there were more male than female births in London, and that the probability of this happening by chance was 1 over 2 to the power 17. From this he inferred that divine providence had intervened in favour of the male sex. Not necessarily the phrase I would have used. I was at University of Cambridge before it went co-ed, and I think the ratio there was 90% male. And certainly some of my colleagues thought this was not divine providence. I met my wife there, so I'm not complaining. But there were certainly many lonely hearts among the male students in those days. But anyway, this purports to be the first significance test. And in Fisher's book, The Design of Experiments, he was very strong on the use of significance, probably as a reaction to the fact that most experiments were being analysed in those days without any kind of probability statement. And so clearly he wanted to make people think in terms of probability. So this is the statement from The Design of Experiments, namely that every experiment may be said to exist only to give the facts a chance of disproving the null hypothesis. I think in his other writings he wasn't quite as strong on significance, and certainly Frank Yates got very het up about the use of stars on the tables that you biologists are inclined to do. To some extent that can be blamed on Fisher and Yates, because Fisher was the person, I think, who realised that it was a lot more effective to give you the critical values in the tables rather than a range of values corresponding to all the different probabilities. So in a sense, that pushed people in that direction. And I'm afraid we're culpable in other ways too, because Donald Preece, one of my other colleagues at Rothamsted, who's a bit of a historian, wanted to try and find out where the stars came from. And this is what he found out. So this is the Rothamsted Annual Report for 1933, and you can see that the stars are there, but they were used as a way of, I would say footnotes, but in fact the notes are at the top of the page. So what they actually were meant to do was basically to give you a linkage to a footnote that told you what the significance was. And so from then on it's been all downhill, and you've used stars, 1, 2, and 3 stars and little crosses and so on to mean significance. Fisher certainly for discrete distributions preferred to see people put probabilities in. But I think these days we tend to focus much more on estimation. And this is a quote, one of my quotes used by Joe Perry in a paper about multiple comparisons, where we have a strong disagreement with you people over the side of the Atlantic, but we don't like them. It's not a discussion I want to get into because I'm outnumbered today, but perhaps in the bar later. And my own view is that the significance test should be like the safety net of a tightrope walker. You need to have it there to give you some confidence, in this instance, that you're not drawing conclusions essentially from random variation, but it certainly shouldn't be an integral part of the act. And you know, what we would encourage you to do, and I'm sure you're all doing this, is look at the biological significance rather than the statistical significance. And here's a little example. These are the 5 best 100 metres times according to Google for a safer pal and for Linford Christie, the fastest ever British runner. I don't think I can postulate any kind of distribution or randomisation theory here, so I'll just do a non-parametric test. And you can see that on the exact probability, it's clear that Powell doesn't have an equal speed to Christie. In fact, he's faster. But from the context of biology, not from athletics statistics, would it matter if they were running for the bus? I think it probably wouldn't. I think they'd both catch it. So, in other words, what we try to do as statisticians these days is to get you to think about the biological significance, having assessed that you're not simply talking about random variation. I'm sure you know all this, but this was just a little diversion. Okay, so for randomization, again, this was controversial, but Fisher and others have used this as a way of justifying the tests that you do on the analysis of variance. And essentially what he was saying was that if you look at the results that you would have obtained by different random arrangements, then over those arrangements, the theoretical distribution would actually turn into an F distribution. So he's looking at large sample theory, but in the context of the number of randomizations that you might have had. And this was checked by Eden and Yates in 1933 with uniformity data and shown to be correct. But it was very controversial, and in fact, the reason Fisher wrote this paper in 1926 was in reaction to a paper by his director which was suggesting systematic arrangements. Now, I wonder how many institutes these days would allow one of their staff to write to contradict the director. Clearly, in the 1920s, it was a much more liberal scientific environment, and possibly to be encouraged. He also had a disagreement with Gossett about this in 1936, but unlike some of the other disagreements he had, this never got personal, and they remained friends right to the end of Gossett's life. More recently, Rosemary Bailey, who joined Rothamsted in 1981 from Edinburgh, has worked on randomization in the context of general balance, and also given an answer to this question that most of you come up with. Now, if I get a randomization that I don't like, am I justified in throwing it away? Well, if you do it in a formal, systematic way, by restrictive randomization, then yes, you can do it. And again, I think there isn't the time to give you all the detail, but design of experiments, Fisher visited America in 1936, and the Boston Globe came up with the summary that Fisher taught experimenters how to experiment. It's worth making the point in this context that Fisher and Rothamsted were very close to Americans, and we've had a lot of collaboration, and certainly I think it's true to say that Rothamsted seeded a lot of the applied statistics within the USA. Notice William Cochrane was at Rothamsted from 1934 to 39, and Kemp Thorne from 41 to 49, and we've had many others on informal research visits, including Randall Tobias, Oliver's boss, when Randall was doing his PhD, supervised partially by Rosemary Bailey. So one of the controversies was factorial design, and Fisher made the comment that people in those days were suggesting that you should ask few questions, or ideally one question at a time. Fisher believed that actually if you had a logical and carefully thought out questionnaire of several factors, you would do much better, and that if you did ask only one question at a time, nature would often refuse to answer until some other topic has been discussed. In other words, if there are interactions, you would confuse yourself by asking one question at a time, and if you asked the question again in a slightly different context, you would get a different answer. And it's one of the areas where you genuinely do get something for nothing. If there's no interaction, then you've combined several one-at-a-time experiments, while if there is an interaction, of course, you're very much wiser. Now, the first of Fisher's designs to be used in practice was with Eden in Journal of Agricultural Science. I think I'm going to have to skip quickly over this because I'm talking more slowly or taking longer than I'd hoped, but I will just... So this is the plan. This is the original analysis of variance. And what's, I think one thing that I just will highlight is that Fisher had several replicates of the null control within the block, and he differentiated between the true error, true plot error that you got from those replicates, and the block treatment interaction, which he called differential response, and checked that there was no block treatment interaction. And this again shows an insight into what was genuinely happening within the experiment. Again, I've got my own analysis of this, but I will skip that and move quickly on to other aspects. In terms of the designs of experiments, later work, Yates developed it further, split plots, strip plots, balanced confounding, balanced incomplete blocks, lattices, pseudo factors, efficiency factors. And then we get to other work done by ex-Rothamsted people, in this case Desmond Patterson, after he moved to Edinburgh, looking at sequences of treatments, following up some of Yates' work on sequences of experiments. And then we have Alpha Designs with Emlyn Williams, looking at variety trials. Donald Preece also did a lot of design work at Rothamsted. This one's for balanced incomplete blocks with two sets of treatments. Then we have General Balance, devised by John Nelder. My own paper with Randall Tobias, looking at this, and our more recent work on search algorithms for designs. On non-normal data, again, Fisher acted as John the Baptist, shall we say, for this. And so we have the first maximum likelihood estimate, analysis of probit data, followed up by David Finney in his books on probit analysis, generalized by John Nelder to other distributions and link functions as generalized linear models, which you use for plant disease data, say for counts and proportions. Developed further by Robert Wedderburn with an important paper here that's the basis of generalized estimating equations, which are used for repeated measurements, and John's paper with Daryl Pregibon from Bell Labs on the modeling of mean and variance. Again, more transatlantic collaboration. Through to our more recent work on generalized linear models with several sources of error. Again, the references are there, but I won't have time to say very much about those. Likelihood, again, a Fisher idea, including this key paper in 1922, which established maximum likelihood as the way to estimate parameters of models, and also develops the important principles of consistency and sufficiency which justify use of maximum likelihood instead of other things like minimizing chi-square, as Pearson was suggesting. Less successful was his venture into fiducial inference, where again I won't have time to say much. That became very controversial. Graham Wilkinson at Rothamsted wanted to, well, hoped he'd resolve the controversy, but the referees decided he hadn't. But as you know, maximum likelihood is very much underpins a lot of the estimation work that we do. Various components, again, Fisher, first in 1918, then Desmond Patterson, after he went to Edinburgh, and Robin Thompson, before he came to Rothamsted, developed the REML algorithm, residual as we call it on our side of the Atlantic, or restricted as you call it, maximum likelihood estimation in linear mixed models. Then we have an important paper by Graham Wilkinson after he went back to Australia, looking at nearest neighbour analysis of field experiments, which set up the whole concept of modelling correlation structures, which you can see Robin Thompson and our colleagues in Australia developed, through to the use of splines for design experiments. Sue Wellham, my colleague at Rothamsted, and Mike Kenwood, who was at Rothamsted, and two of our colleagues in Australia. As a subnote for REML, REML is also used in plant science for microarrays, which is foreshadowing the next talk, and this does provide a link to Fisher's interest in genetics that I won't discuss. But Richard Dawkins has described Fisher as the greatest of Darwin's successors, and L.J. Savage also commented that geneticists sometimes find it hard to believe that Fisher could also have been an important statistician, bearing in mind just how much work he did in genetics. How could he have found time to do all this statistics? Statistical computing was something that Fisher recognised as being very important. This is Frank Yates using the millionaire calculating machine that may not be the original one that Fisher bought, but it was one of several that were bought. And notice the cost, £200, which was as much as Russell had for Fisher's first salary. So computing was very expensive in those days, but Fisher believed it was vital to have good computing equipment and also for statisticians to be in contact directly with the data. Following that, Rothamsted was one of the first institutes to have its own computer, and John Gower, head of the department after John Nelder, believes this to be the first computer to be associated primarily with agricultural research and statistics. And Yates made the point that having this computer on the spot was key to allowing algorithms to be developed for analysis. Next, what's come out of this is our statistical system, GenStat for Windows, which if you want to know more about, I'll be on the agronomic stand for some of the time. So I'm really just coming now to the last but one slide, and the point I want to make is of the importance between statistics and agriculture in those early days. The problems that you've posed in agriculture and the biological research at Rothamsted and elsewhere have spurred many of the advances in statistics. It's a tradition that Fisher started of having problems generated by real sets of data, which we've tried to continue since. So I hope we've helped you, but you've also helped us. Fisher recommended full statistical involvement. This goes back to the idea of not bringing in the statistician until 1919, when the experiment started in 1843. There's a very nice quote from his address to the Indian Statistical Congress, which I'll read out. So, to consult the statistician after an experiment is finished is often merely to ask him to conduct a post-mortem examination. He can perhaps say what the experiment died of. So if you've got statisticians still in your organisations, do please talk to them. And again, with Rosemary Bailey, I've got various examples of what we've done at Rothamsted in the annual report 1989. So the final slide is really just to sum up, and I can't do better, I think, than taking what a non-1971 said in the little booklet that I was given when I joined Rothamsted shortly thereafter, that the statistics department started in 1919 when Fisher was appointed, and essentially, as a result of that, he laid the groundwork for virtually all of what we would call modern statistics. If you want more information, I can thoroughly recommend his daughter Joan Fisher Box's book, Fisher, The Life of a Scientist, but it's out of print and I had some struggle to get a copy, paying something like 10 times what it cost when it was originally published. But it's an excellent book and I very much recommend it. So, that's it.